Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, criminal charges dropped for deaf black man beaten by Phoenix cops. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on October 17th. Tyrone McAlpin, the deaf black man with cerebral palsy, whose brutal beating and tasing at the hands of Phoenix police caused an international outcry for the past week, will no longer face criminal assault charges related to the incident. On Thursday, Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell announced she had completed a review of the case and decided to dismiss all remaining charges against Mr. McAlpin. McAlpin was arrested for resisting arrest and aggravated assault on August 19th. Last week, ABC 15 investigative reporter Dave Biskobing unveiled body camera and security footage that showed Phoenix police officers Ben Harris and Kyle Sue pouncing on McAlpin in a parking lot within 1 second of exiting their police vehicle. Lolin Sangu, the executive director of the social justice organization Mass Liberation Arizona, called the charges against McAlpin absurd and unjustifiable in a statement to Phoenix New Times, adding the charges should never have been filed. Let's be clear. This decision wasn't made because Mitchell values accountability or is capable of making sound decisions. It happened because the public and the media had to rise up, call her out, and demonstrate outrage, and Sangu's statement added. This is a politically opportunistic move meant to save face, not serve the community. Rachel Mitchell's incompetence is glaring. Her office should have immediately seen this case for what it was, a racist attack on a black man who was a victim of police violence. The officer stopped McAlpin while responding to a baseless assault accusation made by a white man at a nearby convenience store. The arrest of McAlpin remains under internal police department review, although Biskobing reported that McAlpin's defense attorneys were not made aware of that fact at the start of his criminal trial. In her statement announcing that charges would be dropped, Mitchell said, "A leader of the local chapter of the NAACP shared his concern with me regarding the prosecution of Mr. Tyrone McAlpin," soon after the video was publicized. She added that her review included examining a large volume of video recordings, police reports, and other materials that have been forwarded to my office. I also convened a large gathering of senior attorneys and members of the community to hear their opinions as they pertain to this case, Mitchell's statement said. In her statement, Nsangu took issue with Mitchell invoking the NAACP to justify a decision she should have made long ago. That it took so long to drop the charges is not just a miscarriage of justice, it's a reflection of how deep racism runs in her office, Nsangu said. Rachel Mitchell should be held fully accountable for enabling this grotesque abuse of power. Mitchell's statement did not address whether Harris or Sue, neither of whom mentioned McAlpin's disabilities in their arrest reports despite being told about them at the time, will face criminal charges. The police department's internal investigation is ongoing. The violent arrest came as trust between the public and Phoenix police is particularly low. In June, the U.S. Department of Justice issued a damning 126-page report on the department. Among other issues, it outlined a pattern by Phoenix's police of using unnecessary force and discriminating against people of color. Additionally, the report noted that Phoenix police officers who commit such constitutional violations rarely face discipline. As Biskobing reported on social media, one of the prosecutors in the case also was involved in a bogus case against a public defender and Black Lives Matter organizer in 2019. In 2020, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office also was caught falsely charging a group of protesters as a made-up criminal street gang. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on October 18th. How many trans girls play sports? GOP has no clue. Still wants them out. Three of Arizona's most powerful Republicans are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to reinstate a 2022 law banning transgender girls from competing in girls' sports. Just don't ask them how many such athletes there actually are. On Thursday, Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn, Senate President Warren Peterson, and outgoing Arizona House Speaker Ben Thoma filed a cert petition asking the Supreme Court to intervene in Doe v. Horn. The lawsuit was brought on behalf of two prepubescent transgender athletes to challenge the Save Women's Sports Act, which was signed into law by Republican Governor Doug Ducey in 2022. The law barred transgender girls from competing in women's sports in Arizona's K-12 public and private school systems, as well as in university undergrad and graduate school. Last year, a federal judge ruled the law violated Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's decision in September. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, has declined to defend the law in court. In a statement released Thursday by the Republican-led Arizona legislature, which misgendered the two students involved in the suit as two boys, Peterson said he's confident the U.S. Supreme Court will make it clear Arizona's Save Women's Sports Act should be enforced. We cannot remain silent and allow these wrongs against women and girls to continue, Peterson's statement added. The GOP effort to reinstate the ban outraged education advocates and LGBTQ plus groups. Madeline Edelman, the founder of LGBTQ plus education advocacy organization, GLSEN Arizona, wrote to Phoenix New Times that banning students who are trans from youth sports, on top of parallel attempts to diminish parents' rights to protect their trans children, sends a terribly harmful message to young people. Chris Coderman, the Director of Governmental Relations for the Arizona School Boards Association, noted that prolonging the lawsuit negatively affects the district involved, Kyrene Elementary School District, which will have to spend more resources defending this law that they didn't ask for. To Tyler Couch, a spokesperson for the education organization Save Our Schools, the GOP cares less about protecting girls' sports and more about perpetuating transphobia. They are trying to other these queer students to create a scapegoat that they can attack to help their electoral odds, Couch said in a statement. At the end of the day, every child should have the freedom to play sports with their friends. Clueless. If Peterson says trans sports participation constitutes wrongs against women and girls, how many such wrongs actually are occurring? How widespread is this supposed scourge of boys changing their genders to play girls' sports? Thoma, Peterson, and Horn have no idea. New Times asked the Arizona Department of Education how many transgender athletes, that is, athletes assigned male at birth, participated in girls' sports throughout the state's public schools during the 2023-24 school year. The department responded that it doesn't track information such as that and referred New Times to the Arizona Interscholastic Association, which oversees school athletics in the state. But the AIA doesn't track that information either, according to spokesperson Seth Polansky. The entire process is confidential between the submitting family, the school, and the AIA's Sports Medicine Advisory Committee, Polansky said in an email. And only a select few members of SMAC are part of the process. Also, due to potential litigation and legislation, the AIA cannot comment about anything related to the process. As Coderman noted, Republicans never had those answers even when they were pushing for the law to pass. At the time, the Save Women's Sports Act was working through the legislature, Coderman said, Those testifying in support of it fumbled the answer to an easy question. Is there an issue with trans girls dominating girls' sports in Arizona? They kept referring to out-of-state issues, Coterbin said. When they're testifying before the Arizona State Legislature, trying to pass an Arizona law, and they can't provide you an example, to me, that says something. Coterbin reiterates trans participation in girls' sports was not and is not a widespread issue that we thought mandated statewide attention via the legislature. So, if no one knows whether transgender girls really are playing girls' sports, much less wreaking havoc on the competition, what exactly is the problem? Why are Republicans so worked up about it? The court case. New Times asked Horn's department the same question. Where is the evidence this is happening, and why invoke the Supreme Court without it? Spokesperson Doug Nick pointed New Times to the website of America First Legal, which moved to intervene in Doe v. Horn last year. The conservative group trumpets that it's fighting back against lawless executive actions on the radical left and has filed several lawsuits in pursuit of right-wing causes. 2 years ago, the Trump-aligned organization sent flyers to Latino voters in Colorado containing misinformation about trans people. But the webpage Nick referenced contains no information about how many transgender girls are playing girls' sports in Arizona. At one point, there were at least two, the pair of students involved in the lawsuit. The two trans girls were 11 and 15 years old when the suit was filed in April 2023. They have identified as girls since they were 5 and 7 years old respectively, and were on puberty-blocking medication after being diagnosed with gender dysphoria, according to court documents. The 11-year-old had been playing girls' soccer and basketball with no objection from her school. The 15-year-old was a member of her school's girls' volleyball team, but was barred from competing due to the law. Though Republican lawmakers claimed in their statement that boys have physiological advantages over girls even before puberty hits, federal judge Jennifer Zips disagreed when granting a preliminary injunction against the law last year. Transgender girls who receive puberty-blocking medication do not have an athletic advantage over other girls, she ruled. Additionally, the three-judge panel on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals noted that the Save Women's Sports Act doesn't prevent transgender men from playing in men's sports and targets only transgender women. Arizona's transgender ban discriminates on its face based on transgender status, wrote Circuit Court Judge Morgan Christen in the panel's ruling. The act treats transgender women and girls less favorably than other students, as they are the only group barred from playing on teams corresponding with their gender identities. Whether the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to consider the Arizona law remains to be seen. The High Court receives more than 7,000 cases a year and only accepts 100 to 150 of them, according to the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts. But if the court does take up the question, the Republicans defending the law have some homework to do. Before decrying the threat transgender athletes represent to girls' sports, they might want to figure out how many such athletes there really are. The Gallego divorce records are out, and they're boring as hell. This next story was written by Caitlin Sievers of the Arizona Mirror and was posted on the New Times website on October 17th. After a 10-month legal fight with an out-of-state conservative news outlet and promises from Republican Kerry Lake of a bombshell contained within, Ruben and Kate Gallego's newly unsealed divorce records revealed no such thing. Both Gallegos are Democrats running for office in the November election, who have accused the Washington Free Beacon, which petitioned for the records, of political motivations. U.S. Congressman Ruben Gallego is hoping to beat Lake, his Republican opponent, in the run for a U.S. Senate seat, which could determine which party controls the chamber. Kate Gallego is up for re-election as Phoenix mayor. The Arizona mirror reviewed the divorce documents unsealed on Thursday and found them to detail standard divorce proceedings, including the dividing of property and assets, as well as custody and child support arrangements. They included no details of any illegal activity and expressly stated, a standard disclosure in divorce proceedings, that no physical abuse had occurred. Both Gallegos, who remain political allies, fought to keep their divorce records under seal. We demand an apology from Carrie Lake for lying about our family and the circumstances of our divorce, Ruben and Kate Gallego said in a written statement. She will stop at nothing to score a cheap political point, even if it means endangering the privacy and well-being of our young son. We have long put our child before all else and will continue to do so. The judge in this case has recognized how standard the records are, and it is shameful that Lake, her allies, and those who amplify her cruelty refuse to respect two people who are just trying to raise a beautiful boy together. Lake has denied any involvement with the suit, but the details surrounding the Gallegos' divorce is one of her frequent talking points when criticizing her opponent. Ruben and Kate were married in 2010, and in 2014, Ruben was elected to represent the 3rd Congressional District in the U.S. House. The two began divorce proceedings in December 2016, and their son was born in January 2017. The Beacon in January filed a suit in Yavapai County Superior Court, where the divorce took place, to unseal the documents from the divorce, which was finalized in 2017. A legal battle followed until an Arizona appeals court on October 10th ordered the records to be unsealed. The Arizona Supreme Court on Wednesday denied the Gallegos' request for an extended stay of the documents' release, citing privacy concerns for their minor child. Lake, who has been consistently trailing by around 8 percentage points in recent polls, frequently mentions the details of the Gallegos' divorce when verbally attacking her opponent. "He's hiding something bad," Lake posted on X Wednesday, the day before the documents were unsealed. In a written statement on Thursday, advisor to Lake's campaign, Caroline Wren, wrote that the revelations from the records were shocking. One of those revelations, Rent said, was that Ruben had asked Kate to pay his attorney fees. An attorney for the Washington Free Beacon wrote in a Thursday filing to the Arizona Supreme Court that the people of Arizona deserve to see the records before voting in the November election. Lake has echoed those comments on social media. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHeroux and posted on October 17th. Charlie Kirk edited a selfie after people roasted his Beta earplugs. Arizona's far-right media prince Charlie Kirk posted the same photo to X and Instagram with one minor difference. Can you spot it? Saturday, the Turning Point USA founder and his wife attended a University of Oregon football game against the Ohio State Buckeyes. The Ducks emerged victorious, and Kirk celebrated by posting a selfie to the site formerly known as Twitter. Immediately, users of the social medium began roasting Kirk for wearing earplugs in the picture, taking Kirk's propensity to refer to men who aren't masculine enough for his taste as beta males, and throwing it right back at him. "Watch on your couch if you're going to wear earplugs," Boston Sports Brothers replied. Another called Kirk's earplugs "charmin' soft." An account called Davy Draft Picks wrote, apparently tongue-in-cheek, "I don't wear earplugs because I just don't trust the science." Plenty of others said slightly more hurtful things. In an apparent attempt to tamp down his beta-ness, Kirk shared the same selfie on Instagram 2 days later. This time, though, his earplugs had been edited out. Social media users dragged him even more. Ha 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 ha, bro. Photoshopped out his earplugs because it's not masculine, wrote one account. Another noted that editing the earplugs out of the original photo because people made fun of you for being beta is extra beta. Phoenix New Times reached out to Kirk via email and through a contact portal on the Turning Point USA website, asking questions about why Kirk edited out the earplugs and if he felt pressured into doing so by the social media backlash. He has not responded. Of course, there's nothing wrong with wearing ear protection at a loud sporting event. But if your brand is judging the masculinity of others, saying things like, "The whole idea of the beta male is one of the most disastrous and disgusting things I've seen in my life," you should probably be able to handle being teased about it. Writer Morgan Fisher brings us this next story that was posted on August 16th. Why did Phoenix police perp walk a teenage girl on the internet? The music is intense, the kind of accompaniment usually reserved for dramatized drug busts and shootouts. It thrums as three Phoenix police officers open a door, enter a room, and arrest a high school girl. The scene, captured on police body camera footage and posted to social media by the Phoenix Police Department on October 3rd, depicts the arrest of a black female student at Sierra Linda High School in Southwest Phoenix. The girl, whose name has been redacted from reports because she is a minor, is accused of making a bogus threat to commit a school shooting. Edited and scored like a hype video, the footage shows cops handcuffing the girl and walking her out of the school. Though her face is blurred, the rest of her appearance is not. The video closes with an animation of prison bars clanging shut as words pop up on the screen. "There is zero tolerance for school threats," it reads. "You will be arrested." The day before the arrest, according to a statement from Sergeant Mabry Reeson at the time, someone posted a threat online alongside a photograph of an area that resembled a common space at the school. Reeson added that the school went on lockdown out of an abundance of caution. The student was charged with multiple felonies, including making terroristic threats, and allegedly told police that the threat was meant to be a joke and got out of hand. Phoenix New Times has also requested the incident report from the arrest, but has yet to receive it. The student has not yet faced discipline from the school, according to Tolleson Union High School District Superintendent Jeremy Kales. Kales added that similar offenses usually trigger a disciplinary hearing, which could result in a long-term suspension or even expulsion. Since a mass shooting rocked a Georgia school in early September, Sierra Linda is just one of many schools in Arizona and across the country that has dealt with hoax threats. "Unfortunately, that's something that we experience on a regular basis at our schools," Kale said. "It just feels too often. Something needs to be done to help bring social media threats under control." The trend is certainly concerning, but some find the video posted by Phoenix police alarming for very different reasons. They see a troubled police force using the arrest of an underage girl to burnish its image while it faces intense scrutiny from the U.S. Department of Justice. They see police deciding to make an example of a minor, saddling her with felony charges, and then perp-walking her on the internet. "I am still shocked at how they put out this media and don't even see the problem with the fact that they cuffed up a child in a classroom," said Lola Nsangu, the executive director of the social justice organization Mass Liberation Arizona. "This is a kid," added criminal defense attorney Brett Royal, who is not involved in the case. "She's innocent until proven guilty." "Would I post this video?" New Times asked a Phoenix police spokesperson why the department shared the video of the minor's arrest. In response, Public Information Officer Rob Scherer said in a written statement that the department's Public Affairs Bureau posted the video and that the Phoenix Police Department uses multiple platforms to keep the community informed on high-profile incidents, including media advisories and social media. Police accountability advocates argue the department could have informed the community without violating the student's privacy. Though the student's face was obscured in the video, the rest of her body was not. I do think there's enough identifying information that's not blurred to potentially identify her, Royal said, which he called problematic, given everyone in her school likely already knows her identity. While Kales applauded Phoenix police for quickly identifying the student who made the threat, he initially didn't want to comment on the department's use of her arrest footage. When pressed by New Times about whether the video was appropriate, Kales said it was painful and not an easy thing to watch, but that he wouldn't say that I feel Phoenix PD is inappropriate. However, he added, would I post that video? I wouldn't. He plans to create his own PSA about school threats, but it doesn't involve using content like that. Royal thinks Phoenix police should have taken a similar tack. If the department wanted to inform the community about an important development, Royal said, it could have issued a statement. If it wanted to scare other kids straight, it should have filmed a PSA, not used real arrest footage of a minor who's yet to be convicted of anything. A suspect, someone not guilty, and a juvenile, why should their body camera be part of your PSA, Royal said. Hire an actor, or just type that. The decision to post the video also echoes issues identified by the DOJ in its years-long investigation of the Phoenix police. In its 126-page report on the department released in June, the DOJ found that Phoenix police both discriminate against people of color and do not take into account the vulnerability of children and their stage of development. The report highlights the department's pattern of demeaning treatment of minors, noting that it can contribute to fear and distrust of law enforcement from the next generation of Phoenix residents. Nsangu, who is black and a mother, agrees. It's not lost on me that this is a black teenager, she said. The department's decision to parade her around as though this is some kind of spectacle makes Nsangu feel much less safe sending my children to a school where a resource officer would do such a thing or where Phoenix PD would be called in. Complete and utter overcharge. The charges the girl now faces also concern Royal and others. Royal has seen kids as young as 12 booked on the same charges, which he called a complete and utter overcharge. And while no one who spoke to the New Times suggested that schools or police shouldn't take threats seriously, they do question what's accomplished by throwing the book at a minor who made an unserious threat. Felony charges and convictions are lifelong, said Isabel Garcia, a community safety strategist for the social justice organization Poder in Action. The youth are learning. Their brains are still developing. They're going to make mistakes. This was clearly a mistake that this youth made. Garcia said arresting and charging a student for a bogus threat won't prevent future threats. Instead, she believes, preventative community-level responses, such as mental health counseling, guidance from social workers, and training on human development would actually help to transform harmful behaviors and help kids make better choices and learn from their mistakes. Phoenix police don't seem to be learning from theirs. Since the release of the DOJ's report, the city of Phoenix has struggled to make a convincing case that its police department does not require federal oversight. Publicly shaming a kid online isn't even the department's most recent concerning incident, or its most serious. For the past week, Phoenix police have faced intense scrutiny over the recent publication of damning body camera footage that shows two cops bum-rushing, beating, and arresting a deaf black man with cerebral palsy. While the department is now investigating the incident, the man they beat is still facing assault charges for allegedly attacking the officers. The incident occurred in August, and the body cam footage wasn't made public until 2 months later, following a public records request. When police arrested the Sierra Linda student, however, the department blasted out the video on its official social media the very same day. That the department apparently is so proud of it shows just how out of touch they are, Nsambu said. The most alarming part is the parading of a young black child around on video and sending that out to the community in an effort to pander for our support, she said, after they've already lost it. Tempe broke the law during Coyotes arena talks, Attorney General says. This next story was written by TJ LeHeru and was posted on October 15th. In November and December 2022, while Tempe explored a possible arena development to woo the Arizona Coyotes to town, the City Council held three closed-door meetings. During these meetings, Mayor Corey Woods and council members received reports from Strategy 48, a consulting group the council had hired to monitor social media opposition to the arena plan. By excluding the public, the meetings were illegal, according to the Office of Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays. In a letter received by the Tempe City Attorney on October 12th, Mays' office said the three sessions with Strategy 48 violated Arizona's open meetings law. As a result of the ruling, council members must receive training on the open meetings law by December 9th, according to the letter. The training materials have to be approved by the Attorney General. Tempe must also prominently display the letter about the violation on its website for 6 months. Tempe cannot appeal the decision, said Richie Taylor, Communications Director for the Attorney General's Office. The city hired the consulting group on October 15, 2022. According to its contract, Strategy 48 was paid to identify social media pages and groups that could provide a platform for project opposition to publicize their concerns, and analyze digital media stories and posts to better understand potential opposition messaging strategy. The contract with Strategy 48 was signed by the city manager at the time and fell under the dollar threshold that required council approval. In a separate letter sent last week, the Attorney General's office ruled that the city did nothing improper by signing the contract. However, the council then held three more executive session meetings with Strategy 48 on November 3rd, November 22nd, and December 15th, 2022, to receive reports on the firm's work. Those meetings did violate the law and should have been held publicly, the Attorney General's office said. The City Council ultimately terminated the contract with the consulting firm on December 23rd, 2022, but not before paying it $32,000 to surveil the internet for anti-arena posts. Tempe voters ultimately rejected the Coyotes arena plan in a May 2023 referendum after a major organizing effort against the plan from organizations such as Tempe First. Earlier this year, after playing a season at the 5,000-seat Mullet Arena in Tempe, the Coyotes officially moved to Salt Lake City. The State Attorney General's office issued a correct opinion, said Tempe First founder Ron Tapscott in a written statement to Phoenix New Times. But it appears Mayor Corey Woods and council would rather deflect the issue. Rather than accepting responsibility for this misadvised adventure, they would rather hide behind public relations and marketing. Prominently displayed? It does appear Tempe isn't quite abiding by the Attorney General's requirements. As of Tuesday afternoon, the city's website homepage featured a press release referencing the first letter from the Attorney General's office. No violations found by Attorney General's office regarding Arizona Coyotes referendum election, it pronounced. The letter about the open meetings violations, which the city was required to prominently display, is more difficult to find. Early Tuesday afternoon, Tempe City Attorney Eric Anderson told New Times where it was relegated, to the very bottom of the city clerk's webpage. When asked if he thought the letter was prominently displayed, Anderson replied, "It is, in my opinion. Yeah." Within 2 hours of Anderson's conversation with New Times, the city added another press release to its website. It featured a noticeably neutral title: Arizona Attorney General's Office Makes Determination on Strategy 48 Contract and Reports. That release, dated 3 days before its posting, does not flatly say that the city violated the open meeting law. The opening sentence, which references the first letter from May's office about the contract with Strategy 48, gives the opposite impression. Later, the release notes that some reports given by Strategy 48 during executive sessions were not permissible topics for the three meetings. Tempe City Council had no reason to consider that the Strategy 48 updates were not in compliance with open meeting laws, the release added. As for the required training on open meeting law, Tempe spokesperson Chris Baxter-Ging said the city attorney provided open meeting law training to the council at a retreat in June. The city attorney will provide those training materials to the AG and discuss any additional training that might be necessary, Baxter-Ging said. Coming up, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on October 15th. A Democrat campaign office keeps getting shot. Neighbors are on edge. On a recent afternoon at a West Tempe strip mall, the Arizona Barber Academy was busy as usual. One student cut a customer's hair, while others cleaned their stations or played on their phones, waiting for new clients to walk in. Academy founder Hillary Allegre trains roughly a dozen students at the salon in the Tempe Village Shopping Center, near the intersection of Priest Drive and Southern Avenue. Lately, though, teaching the next generation of barbers has hardly been her only concern. Next door to Allegri's establishment, a nondescript office is riddled with bullet holes. Until recently, it was a field office belonging to the Arizona Democratic Party. Now it's closed, a silent symbol of the nation's increasing political tension ahead of the looming November 5th election. Three times in the last month, someone has come by in the middle of the night and shot at the office, once with a BB gun, and at least once with an actual firearm. All shootings occurred between midnight and 1 a.m., with the last happening on October 6th. At least five large bullet holes dot the office's front windows and door, spawning cracks that spread like spiderwebs. A security camera has been installed at the front door, but these days it guards only a collection of white and blue Kamala and Arizona for Harris campaign signs. The office has been dormant since the first shooting on September 16th, Allegre said. On Friday, the Arizona Republic reported that the office was shut down for good and that campaign operations had been moved to other undisclosed locations. Phoenix New Times reached out to party spokespeople but has not heard back. The investigation into the shootings remains open, and Tempe police are still trying to track down the shooter. New Times requested police documents from the incidents, but has yet to receive them. No incidents have occurred since staffers officially vacated the premises, although activity at the office has been sparse since the initial shooting, but the strip mall's other businesses are still a bit rattled. Allegre said that she pushed her landlord to close the office. "I'm sorry, but they just got to go," she told New Times last week. "I said to my landlord after the last time, 'They need to go. because my boys don't feel safe. Nearby, a barber in training spoke up. I'm scared to get shot, the student said. Whoever has been targeting the office also has placed a variety of other establishments in the crosshairs. A daycare center, which has a public-facing playground, is located near Allegra's Barber Academy. The shopping center also is home to a Planet Fitness, a hair and beauty supply store, a cash lender, a doctor's office, and a church, among other businesses. Paula Lopez works as a technician at Tempe Pet Clinic. It's scary, she said of the shootings. We walk this area all the time. She'd only been aware of the first shooting, not the subsequent two. That political violence would rear its head here in this nondescript shopping center shocks her. You hear about these things coming from bigger cities, but for it to happen here in Tempe, that's really crazy, Lopez said. If you heard it happened in like Washington, D.C., you're like, yeah, it's Washington, D.C., or even like New York. But Tempe? On edge. Since the first shooting, Lopez and her co-workers have taken measures to protect themselves. They walk to their cars in groups, park next to each other, and carry pepper spray. Measures recommended by Tempe police officers. We usually leave around the same time, and then we always kind of keep an eye out, she said. It's really scary that that's what society's come to. Janice Thomas works as a shift manager for Cash One, a direct lender located on the eastern end of the strip mall. The shootings have left her feeling just on edge a little bit, she said. We're on guard more, checking our surroundings for sure. Next door at Taco Nazo, cashier Jane Lee Juarez is less nervous about the shooting. It doesn't really surprise me, she said. The taco shop is no stranger to violence, she noted. The restaurant shares a wall with Cash One, said Juarez, and there have been attempts to break into the lender by first breaking into Taco Nazo. The taqueria now has a metal roll-down security gate on the front door. It basically can happen anywhere, Juarez said, though she admitted the shooting at the campaign office was kind of scary. At Waba Hair and Beauty Supply, some employees are still nervous, manager Brianna Key said. But after talking to police, following the most recent shooting incident, she is less concerned. Obviously, if you hear that there's a shooting right by, and this is the second time that this has happened, it is a little nerve-wracking, Key said. But it seems like everything is under control. The police are doing a thorough investigation on it, so hopefully they figure out who it was. Police do seem to have been asking around. Every person who spoke with New Times said investigators have stopped by to ask questions. Officers asked for security camera footage, though many workers said that would prove only so helpful. Most cameras at the shopping center point inward. However, one security camera did pick something out. On October 9th, Tempe police put out a social media call for information on a suspect's car, which the department described as a white Toyota Highlander. That suggests police are getting closer to identifying the culprit, but even then, danger lurks. The day Allegra spoke to New Times, 2 days after Tempe police released the bulletin about the car, she swears she saw it in a nearby parking structure. That car that was on that picture, it looked like the car that was sitting out over on the edge of the car park this morning as I came past, she said. I don't know whether it was it, but it looked like it. And I know my cars. Next, a story written by Tom Reardon and posted on October 17th. Phoenix label Fervor Records marks 35 years with Rhythm Room Show. No matter how you shake it, try to break it, or look at it, 35 years is a long time. In rock and roll terms, it's 8 years longer than Janis, Jimmy, or Jim got on the planet. And in terms of a local record label, it's akin to being from a prehistoric era. On Sunday, October 20th, Sunny Slope's Fervor Records celebrates its 35th anniversary with a party at the Rhythm Room in Phoenix. Local legends Francine Reed, Hans Olsen, and Chuck Wall, along with Fervor artists Andy Gonzalez and the Sugar Thieves, will grace the stage at the equally legendary Arizona venue. It is fitting, actually, that the party is located at the Rhythm Room, as many of the acts featured by Fervor over the years have graced the small but sturdy stage. After meeting during a recording session back in 2001, Fervor founder David Hilker and his partner Jeff Freundlich hit it off. Freundlich joined the team in 2002. The two men see the anniversary in a light that reflects their excellent combination of humor, dedication, and devotion to Arizona music. Wow, it has gone by fast, and it doesn't seem like work. For me, it's kind of all I've ever done, and it's the only thing I know how to do, so if it didn't work, I'm fucked, Hilker says, laughing. For me, it's just a dream come true. I'm a big advocate for Arizona. I've lived out here since the year 2000, and when people ask me why I love Arizona, I say, it's where all my dreams come true. It's amazing, and it is a gift that we get to do what we do every single day. Whether it is nurturing artists or pitching music for film and TV, knowing that we are getting music out there to larger audiences, those are really powerful and meaningful things in both my life and Dave's life. It's a gift, Freundlich says. Hilker started the label with Ted Bolger, Michael Pick, and Ron Charlesworth in 1989. The foursome released their first CD, a compilation called Southwest Holiday, in 1990, and donated all the proceeds to a local charity, CAS, Central Arizona Shelter Services. This began a long history of working to promote and preserve local music. Over time, Bolger, Charlesworth and Pick left the label for various reasons, but Hilker continued on. Early on, Fervor wasn't really making any money, so the original partners put their energy into other things that they were pursuing. I decided to stick it out and open the recording studio side of things and produced artists. I went to LA and shopped the artists, did compilations and local releases, and eventually some of the songs got into TV shows, Hilker says. This allowed Hilker to keep the label doors open and build on the publishing side of the business. After bringing Freundlich, a New York native, into the fold in 2002, the partnership was able to grow and reach out to local musicians and their families to begin acquiring more music to release and shop to movies, television, and video game publishers. If you listen to Freundlich and Hilker, the recipe for their success becomes quite clear. One of the key ingredients is being open to opportunity. The reason this label has been successful is that we are naturally curious people, and we're looking for opportunities for the music. So, when an opportunity comes along to sublicense a soul tune on a 45 in Spain that leads to crate digging by a DJ like Jamie XX, and then turns into a sample from a tune in our catalog from the 1970s, you're talking about the dominoes all falling into place, Freundlich says. Currently, Fervor Records releases both new recordings from local artists across multiple genres and hard-to-find local artists from years gone past. On the docket for upcoming releases are a string of singles by local rockers Noonday Devils and another string of singles by R&B group Black Nostalgia. Paris James, Mark Zubia, and Keegan will have solo releases coming out in 2025 as well. Freundlich and Hilker have a healthy respect for the difficulty that comes with being partners in a commonly cutthroat business like the music industry. Their continued passion for Fervor Records comes from a few places. Part of it is being of the legacy of Arizona. It's great to be able to represent a lot of this music and put out new music, too. Every day, it's different, really. It's the same, but different, because there are always new opportunities and things we didn't expect, Hilker says. Local blues legend Hans Olsen wanted to chime in here, too. I think I was one of the first blues artists that Fervor signed. I've done several albums for them now, They've placed a lot of my songs on TV shows. I've known David Hilker since long before he started the label. I've always thought he was a great guy who really had the passion for music. I do trust these guys. After 50 plus years in the music business, I can say that I can't think of anyone else I can say that about. All the people playing at the 35th anniversary are close friends. I'm honored to be on the same bill with them. It will be an epic day of music, Olson wrote in an email. Trust and respect play a huge role, too, in the relationship that Hilker and Freundlich have built as partners and friends. Dave and I, knowing that we can rely on each other and trust each other to put the best foot forward and refine our ideas into something palpable and manageable, is how these things ultimately come together, Freundlich says, before Hilker sums it up. Jeff and I literally sit across the desk from each other every day and stare each other in the face. We don't always agree on everything, but the best ideas float to the top and win. Because we have these ideas, and we beat them up in every possible way that we can to determine what's the best way to serve the music and the artists the best. And we have time for one more story on this week's program. Let's take a look at this one, written by Marshall Baker of Cronkite News and posted on the New Times website on October 18th. After 2022, tribal involvement in State Fair's Native American Rodeo waned. The Arizona State Fair is one of Arizona's longest-standing traditions, dating back almost 30 years before statehood. Starting all the way back in 1884, it's one of the largest fairs in the United States, bringing in over 1.4 million visitors in 2023. The Native American Rodeo is part of the rich tradition of the fair, with spectators and competitors from tribal nations across the country. It celebrates the indigenous peoples who have influenced the history of Arizona. It is one of the most popular events among indigenous communities at the fair, but there are questions surrounding their involvement with all aspects of the rodeo. I think to bring back some of the native culture that we don't have like we used to, I think that would be good, says Jerry Honeycutt of Honeycutt Rodeo Company. He's a third-generation stock contractor, and his family has been working with the state fair as long as he can remember. My grandpa, Walt Alsbaugh, was at this rodeo many, many years ago. He started in the 40s, and I think his first Arizona State Fair was in the late 50s. And our family has been here this long, providing the livestock for the rodeo. Honeycutt Rodeo, based in Alamosa, Colorado, is the sole stock contractor for the Native American Rodeo and is in charge of the production of the entire event, laying the dirt, bringing in the calves and bulls, even bringing in the rodeo clowns. However, it is not an indigenous-led company. In 2022, the Native American Rodeo was held with consultation from the Arizona Native American Rodeo Committee, ASNAR, an organization that was formed to work with state fair officials. A bill was introduced in the Arizona Senate by Senator Teresa Hatafly, Democrat Tuba City, in February of 2023, that would have solidified the committee of five tribal members appointed by the governor to oversee and facilitate the rodeo. In addition to the committee, the bill would have established the Native American Rodeo Fund of $300,000 annually from the state general fund. The bill died in the Senate that year. The ASNAR is no longer assisting in the rodeo, and not much is known about why the organization ended its involvement. We used to have all kinds of Native dancers and stuff, and that was pretty cool. But that's when the committee was there doing that. But I'm not sure what happened with the committee, Honeycutt says. And so, that kind of went away. And then the fair just went back to the way it always is. The Arizona State Fair, ASNAR officials, and Hatafly did not respond to requests for comment. In addition to the indigenous dancers and singers, the rodeo also showcased indigenous rodeo pageantry, a staple in indigenous rodeos all across the country. Rodeo pageantry blends traditional beauty pageants with rodeo competition. Contestants are judged on appearance, character, and horsemanship skills. Winners earn the title of rodeo queen or princess and represent that rodeo as they travel throughout the country. I think it's cool when everybody can come together for one purpose, and I think this country needs more of that, Honeycutt says. I don't care what you look like, what color you are, we all got one purpose. We need to come together and make it happen. And at the rodeo, we all come together to make the best rodeo we can for the people that come to the fair. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for more interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Albrock. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, click on On-Demand Broadcasts. Scroll down to the program you're interested in and click on Listen.